You've got mail.
As a futurist, I get a lot of strange but occasionally interesting email. Last week, a particularly large message appeared in my inbox. I was about to delete, but for some reason I stopped. After I read a bit, I realized that this was an unusual piece of writing.
What would you do if you got mail from the year 2084? Michael Rogers, a practical futurist who shares his insights with startups and Fortune 500 companies, uses that classic time travel trope in a novel titled Email from the Future. The book lays out a game plan for dealing with social challenges ranging from climate change to wealth inequality. In Michael Rogers' world, everybody gets paid a living income, and nobody is ultra-rich. But is this vision of the future at all practical? Greetings, Earthlings! I'm Alan Boyle, your host for the Fiction Science Podcast, coming to you from the place where science and technology intersect with fiction and popular culture. Join Michael Rogers and me as we talk about how closely the world of email from the future matches real-world trends in science and society. I've known Michael Rogers since the early 2000s when he wrote a column called The Practical Futurist for MSNBC.com, the website that I was working for at the time. Michael still calls himself the practical futurist, but some of the ideas that he writes about in his new book, Email from the Future, may seem somewhat impractical or at least improbable. By the year 2084, could we really eliminate greed, solve the climate crisis, and figure out how to send email messages describing those successes 62 years into the past? If we're speaking pragmatically, Email from the Future is a classic utopian novel along the lines of Thomas More's Utopia in the 16th century, Gulliver's Travels in the 18th century, and Ecotopia in the 20th century. The advanced technologies and social reforms described in the book may not reflect what could actually happen, but they do serve as a mirror to reflect what the author wishes could happen and to show where present-day society is falling short. When Michael and I got together over Zoom to talk about the book, I started out by asking him what kind of message he's hoping to get across in his Email from the Future.
I think I fell into the whole utopia world kind of accidentally, because this started out as a science fiction story about quantum time shifting, and it had various plot twists. But suddenly a voice began to come through from the future that was really describing utopia. And I didn't even realize that until I was partway through the writing. And then I went back and read every single utopia novel from 1516 onward. I guess the thing that I'm trying to say is something that I also tell organizations that I work with as a futurist, which is you need a point in the future towards which you can navigate, because you can never go straight to the future. There's always something in the way. The technology isn't ready, or people aren't trained. There's all kinds of problems like that. So what you need to do is, going towards the future is a little like sailing upwind. You have to tack back and forth around the obstacles. But every once in a while, you have to raise up your head and look and make sure you're still going in approximately the right direction. Now, usually I do that with organizations on a time frame of 8 to 10 years. But to turn societies around, it takes a little bit longer. So in a sense, this is my attempt to put a point out on the horizon in 2084 for where we could end up if we do mostly everything right for the next 50 or 60 years.
I think this book started out as a blog post, if I'm not mistaken. And maybe you could tell me a little bit more about the genesis of the book. Was it something that you just thought you wanted to do something completely different as science fiction, and then it turned into a futurist description of 2084? Or was there
a
different...
Yes, exactly. It started out as a short story. And that I posted, which involved the same notion of time shifting of electrons, but it was sort of devious and suggested a dystopian future. And I set that aside for a while. And then the voice just kept coming back to me. And I said, there's more that I can do with this. And so maybe if you've survived as a futurist as long as I have, you've got to be an optimist, because otherwise, how could you stand to think about this stuff all the time?
Well, it's not all sunshine and light. Between now and 84, you describe a worsening climate crisis, an unrest that basically turns into an uprising against the world's mega corporations. Do you think that it'll take something that extreme to solve the challenges posed by climate change and wealth inequality? Or did you amp things up in the interest of telling a good story?
I always try to tell a good story. But when I look at this, it seems to me, and I tell audiences this also, that I think it's going to take a fundamental almost shift of humanity to meet this threat on, because it is a global threat. And I believe, I sort of suggest in the book, that as the internet becomes stronger and better at translating languages, and we begin to create more of a global mind, there will be a point at which humans take a major spiritual shift and say, we have to fix this planet. And I do believe it's going to be younger people. I think Gen Z and their younger siblings are the heroes of my book, partly thrust into it, not something they wanted, but something that they had to do. It's interesting. I suspect that that point has gone through. I just read a review by someone who said, well, the book starts out with the character being a little bit martyrish or complaining. He says, but of course, I'm Gen Z, so what do I know? Well, some accuracy in that.
Well, for some readers, Email from the Future could well describe a utopia where advanced medicine, artificial intelligence, environmental best practices, and universal basic income solve a lot of the problems we face today. But I think that you know that other readers might see the world you describe as a nightmare for individual liberty and ambition. What would you say to those readers?
I think that the way that I've designed that world, there's plenty of room for liberty. And I do think that we're going to move in that direction, particularly in the online world. I believe we're going to be sort of led in that direction by Brussels. I think the EU is really taking the first steps. But ultimately, I think that we will end up with an internet, a virtual world, at least, that is much more accommodating to privacy, but focuses also on real identities, that becomes more of a communal sort of communication, common ground, rather than what it is now, which is basically either a commercial engine to sell whatever is possible to sell, including privacy, data, all of those things, or a completely autocratic engine, as we see in China and increasingly in Russia. So, you know, I've tried to sort of design an educational system for the future based on real technologies that exist today, in which each student essentially has their own tutor who basically tracks them throughout their lives and does sort of customized teaching, keeps track of them, but, you know, not in a negative way, keeps track of them in order to make sure that their own potential is reached. Indeed, the author of my book was dyslectic. The author within the book was dyslectic and didn't really learn how to write until he was 40 years old. He was taught by one of the first generation of these tutors that I think will be commonplace.
Well, I love the way that you framed the book as an actual email from the future with a narrator named Aldous. And I want to return to all those technologies that Aldous describes. But I thought I would concentrate first on the filthy lucre aspect. Would it be fair to say that your scenario for 2084 has no place for the ultra-rich? I know that Aldous talks about some high-income entertainers and entrepreneurs, but there's nobody on the scale of Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates. Am I right in that?
That's right, because I think what society will realize in the next decade or so is that we've sort of set up a gigantic global vacuuming system that just lets, once you've got your first billion, lets you just continue to suck resources and dollars out of the environment and stack them up somewhere where they're actually not doing society any good at all. So in my book, there is a realization specifically around climate change and the fact that it's going to cost trillions of dollars to fix the planet. So there's, again, a big social shift in which the ultra-rich no longer look like heroes. They actually look like people who are withholding resources that could be saving lives.
One of the concepts you mentioned was the Bill Gates tax. Tell me a little bit more about that.
That's an interesting one that I think has already gotten some good reactions from people, which is... traditionally we said automation always, destroys jobs, but creates new jobs. But I think in the last decade or so, more and more economists are saying, maybe this time is different as we automate so many parts of work and begin to really have, with machine learning, technologies that can do quite a bit that humans can do, that we may be running into a situation where the people who own the robots and the people who own the software, in other words, the ones who have the capital, are actually making all the gains. And where does that leave the workers? Well, it was Gates, I think, originally, who said that, we should have a robot tax. And he meant that sort of figuratively, but that there needed to be some way that the riches of total automation got recycled back into society rather than into the pockets of the ultra rich.
And another aspect that comes out is the idea that people have figured out that space exploration by humans and space tourism is a dead end, that space exploration continues thanks to telepresence. But in terms of the sorts of things that people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are talking about today, having millions of people living and working in space, you say that folks have figured out by 2084 that that's just not going to work. Is that the way you feel about it? Because a lot of people say, oh, space is the new frontier and there are trillions of dollars to be made in space commerce.
But that was a hard thing for me to write because I was one of those kids who, woke up in the middle of the night with my shortwave radio to see if I could pick up signals from the Mercury capsule as it went overhead. I'm dating myself there, but you actually could. And so it was difficult for me to say that when you look at the challenges of the planet itself, we really should postpone some of the really big expenses that we're making in terms of space, because it's not clear what's out there for us. I mean, we need to go to Mars to terraform it. We really need to terraform Earth to make it habitable again before we go to any other planets. So, yes, I think it was a hard argument for me to make because, the space program has been extremely important, I think, to creating some goods for society and some real technology kinds of breakthroughs. But I don't think that over the next 50 years, that's where we're going to want to put our money.
Another thing is that it sounds as if good old-fashioned war might be obsolete in 2084. I realize that the book was written before the war in Ukraine, but has that conflict caused you to rethink the scenarios for the international politics of the future?
Not completely, because I think that the world will learn a lot from the Ukraine invasion and the way that the countries have responded to it, and particularly the way that we are being sort of held up by our dependence on fossil fuels. It's interesting, in the book, I have another war that begins in the Middle East. And that's out around, I think it happens in 2028 or 2030, maybe even in the early 30s. But it begins to look like Israel, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran are about to start a major war. And by then, we know that they all have nuclear weapons. But this time, the countries of the world know that having a nuclear war is a really bad idea. So they say they will completely sanction all four of those countries, completely cut them off from the global system unless they reach a peace treaty. Now, we can do that in, say, the early 30s because we've gotten off the dependence on oil. So that's one piece that fits. But there will always be these the random crazy person who manages to take over. But I think that in the future, we'll have a more globalized system to keep that under control.
Well, I'd love to run through some of the concepts described in the book and ask you how close we are to turning those concepts into reality. So consider this something of a lightning round. I'll just throw out digital twins for predictive medicine and epidemiology.
Digital twins are a direct projection from technology we have today. And I think if 30 or 40 years from now, medical science doesn't create digital twins of every patient, that will be a huge loss. We're going to have the technology for it. We're developing, you know, all the sort of personal measurement devices, the wearables, a lot of venture capital going into wearable diagnostic devices now because telemedicine accelerated so quickly during the pandemic. And the technology for creating sort of an anonymized, but basically a global or a countrywide database that follows outcomes of people's habits and the ways the diseases that they get and the way that they're treated, and that pulls all that together so that it informs the record of each individual. I'd say the digital twin concept is well within reality.
Voltron, the process for having artificial intelligence facilitate assessments of public opinion.
Yes, Voltron, that comes also from technology that exists today, very sophisticated new machine learning technology that's able to sort of go through multiple social networks and come back and tell corporate America, what do people really need in a paper towel? What are their true opinions about wet dog food? My feeling is that in more enlightened times, a few decades from now, we'll just turn that around and make it a way to sort of create an ongoing public opinion sphere.
Breeding greed out of the genome.
Yes. Well, the thing that happens, of course, that makes that possible is the discovery that greed is, in fact, a disease. It's a disease, you know, a little like alcoholism, or earlier it was epilepsy that was thought to be a moral failing. And now we know that that's the result of some genes going bad. It'll turn out greed is the same thing. And in this case, it turns out that the greed, like most of the deep human traits, is a large gene cluster, actually. There's a number of genes involved. So you can't really go in and sort of edit it out. It will turn out that gene editing on that scale just doesn't work. Nature is more complicated. Every time we try something in the biologic sciences, it turns out nature is a little more complicated than we thought. But in this case, the greed cluster can be recognized, and then there's all sorts of ways to treat it. And of course, ultimately, if people really have compulsive greed by, you know, 2080, that's a terribly embarrassing thing to have, because greed and the ultra-rich are not well thought of. So it turns out there's actually some recombinant DNA technologies that can be used to quiet it down.
Okay. Living income, also known as universal basic income.
This, I think, the notion of, I call it living income, because that's sort of the ultimate point of it, is to keep people living in a world where I think things like housing and healthcare will be basic rights. I think it's going to be necessary in a very complicated society where I believe people are going to start changing jobs more quickly than we did in the past. We're going to have to step back often and get retrained. It's going to be a very fluid kind of job situation. And I think people will need this living income to sort of keep them going between various kinds of employment. If we don't do that, we're not going to have the kind of flexible workforce that we really need. So ultimately, I think this also ties back into the question of automation. And the fact that if we truly automate much of society, we're in a sense becoming much richer as a society. And if we sort of begin to share that, in a way, living income is also a form of the Gates robot tax.
True ID and the Fading of Anonymity.
Mm. This is one that is very controversial, and I've talked about this for 10 years now and actually tend to get really, really flamed whenever it comes up. But it seems to me that the idea of having solid personal identities, something like a driver's license or a passport that you use on the internet in the virtual world when you're doing almost anything important in the future, that will include things like, you know, giving information. Where does this information come from? People will in the future say, why would you trust information from someone who is hiding their identity? Now, quickly, I should say that there are situations in which anonymity is necessary. You would always have a system where you can shut off your identification and do so in a way that is truly anonymous. Today, we have all kinds of systems where people think they're anonymous, but in fact, they're trailing, you know, bits behind them that that people with the right technology can pick out. So I think that having firm identities on the internet will do a great deal for both healing the sort of the nature of the internet culture and for making commerce work more smoothly.
Molecular synthesis of materials, including gold and rare earth minerals.
Now, this is one that I sort of have two classes of technology in this book. One is technology that comes straight out of things that I see today and that I'm simply extrapolating out further. But I thought for the book, I should put in a few surprises because there's always surprises that come along in science. So the two areas that I was interested in, well, one is time shifting, which we can talk about later, but the other one was material synthesis, because I think that's one of the really underappreciated science and technology areas today. So much interesting work is going on at the nano level in terms of creating new materials that replace existing ones and are even better than existing ones. But I took it a step further and decided to even include the idea that we can synthesize elements like gold. Now, of course, today we can synthesize elements like gold, but we do it in a nuclear reactor and we make gold nanoparticles. So I postulated that we figure out a better way to do that. And the strange thing is, I wrote that scene about the synthesized gold ingot, which was the way that the labs proclaimed to the world that they could now synthesize elemental metals. I wrote that, and then I realized that in a number of the older utopias from hundreds of years ago, gold showed up as a sign of a changed society. In one of them, either gold was very inexpensive and everyone wore gold. In another one, everything in the city was made of gold. So in a very strange way, I fell in. It's almost as if there is an utopia theme that sort of runs through the species. And this gold thing just came up out of that and bit me.
Quantum time shifting actually is on my list. And so we might as well address that while we're here. That is the explanation for how we were able to receive something from 2084.
Well, this is probably the most far-fetched of these ideas, but I did want to have something, that would let my plot go forward. And it's interesting, you know, when you go back to the old utopias, the ones from hundreds of years ago, they had it easier because basically they just had sailors who got lost at sea and ended up debarking on an island in which they found a utopia. And then they came back to London to tell everyone about it. That was easy until we had a complete globe of the world, in which case you couldn't do that anymore. So we did time travel starting in the 19th century. So I needed that as a plot device, time shifting. But it also occurred to me that time and gravitation, those are two parts of physics that still remain sort of mysterious to us. And, you know, thus far, we've learned to manipulate most everything that we ultimately understand. So why not bring that in as a possibility? Now, note that it's only at the quantum level. It only involves electrons. So I'm not asking too much here. But I would say it's not impossible.
Right. That's why Aldous is not able to actually come back to the world of the 2020s. He has to content himself with sending a plain text email. But it's a fascinating idea. Virtual love?
Yes. It will turn out that there are people who actually prefer to have entirely virtual relationships and even virtual marriages, in which they may not even see each other in real life very often, if at all, but it will have the same sort of resonance as a long-term and emotional resonance as a long-term real-world marriage. I think that the technology for, as I put it in the book, intimate relations will become much, much better as we go forward. As we both know, to put it bluntly, pornography has actually sort of sped a lot of technologic developments over the years, beginning with the videotape. So I suspect that there will be people who are happily married and don't really see each other in person. In fact, Aldous's wife in the book is a therapist who deals with couples who have jealousy problems in their virtual marriages.
And nursing home robots, also known as elder bots.
Yes, elder bots, become, and we're already seeing this start, is a kind of companion for elderly people living alone. Those are going to get better and better and smarter and smarter. I think that in most cases, we're going to try to balance that with human caretakers. And a big theme in my book is that we really will learn when we need a real person, when we need a bot, when we can do something in the virtual world, when it's better in the physical world, that all of this is knowledge that will come to us over the decades of the virtual and artificial intelligent world. So the elder bots ultimately become sometimes a problem, because it turns out that the very old, and by 2080, we're talking about people in their early hundreds, moving on to their mid hundreds, that they may like their elder bot more than they like human caretakers. So there's even a plot that sort of functions around that.
The last item on my list is upholding, which, as I understand it, is basically uploading the complete information content of a human brain, even though you don't know what to do with that content.
Exactly. Yes, I call it upholding, not uploading, because it's clear we learned that all of the experiments and attempts that have been made during the 20s and 30s and 40s in the 21st century, it turns out you really can't upload a human consciousness and have it continue to function. Turns out that human consciousness of any kind, requires a physical container with some sense of mortality. That gives you consciousness. But, you know, we perennially, as humans, we like to sort of save something that we hope might restore some part of us in the afterlife. So in the book, it becomes the connectome, which is essentially the mathematical pattern of all the neurons in the brain. Basically a schematic, if you would call it that, that we upload to save. Why? We're not quite sure, but in a sense, we're burying our brains in the sky with some hope that something may come of it.
Well, I was intrigued by your description of Chardinism, particularly because I'm a big fan of Teilhard de Chardin and his writings about the noosphere. In the book, you describe a scenario in which stronger digital connections between people lead to phenomena such as dream sharing and promnesia. That phenomenon supposedly leads to a deep spiritual sense of global connectedness, which Teilhard de Chardin called the noosphere, and which is called the noose in your book. Have you run across any suggestions that promnesia, which is kind of a sense of deja vu, or the rise of the noosphere, could be anything other than a science fiction plot device?
I'm beginning to think that we're already seeing some very early signs in the existing internet. I mean, one first step is simply the globalization of entertainment, the globalization of memes, that we begin to share more and more of a common vocabulary, a common set of images. I've heard people argue that the 15-year-old in Nashville has more in common with the 15-year-old in South Korea than they do with their 35-year-old neighbor across the street. And that is true of this generation. It's really beginning to become much more global. And it seems to me it's not a big leap to say that, in a sense, this is an extension of our own intelligence and an evolutionary step in many ways. That's why Chardin is so interesting, because, of course, he was, although the church didn't like him to do this, he was a great fan of evolution and felt that evolution was in fact, almost a spiritual kind of function. So I think it's possible. We have to remember this is so early days in the internet, you know, that 50 years from now, we will look back and go, wow, we were really unsophisticated and clumsy in our virtual world experiences. We didn't know what we were doing. And that's exactly right. The first fish that crawled out of the ocean onto the land was not a good walker by any means, and probably had their parents back in the ocean going, come on back, don't go there, it's too dangerous. So I think we've got some interesting evolution ahead of us.
Well, we've touched upon a whole bunch of technologies, and in a sense, I'm a little sorry about that because it's a little bit of a spoiler perhaps for the book, but I think we should stress that there's a very human story that unfolds in the course of Email from the Future. And so I think that people are going to want to pick up the book just to read that human story about what happens to Aldous and his loved ones and everybody who surrounds him in society. Are there any other intersections of science and fiction that you want to point out from the book, or should we just tell people to go buy the book?
Well, I think that's always a good message. Let's see. I think the other piece that interests me in the book is the rise of engineered meat, and the fact that, you know, in the book, actually by 2084, you have to specify that you're talking about animal flesh if you mean real meat, because everyone has grown up on bioreactor cultured cell meat, which by then is actually very tasty. And many people don't like the taste of real meat when they finally try it. So I think that's something we're already seeing. I think even the fast food chains are surprised at how quickly their customers were asking for non-meat meat products. So that's one that's interesting. And it would have a huge impact on climate change and the fate of the Amazon basin if we begin to really cut back on, quote, meat and got more interested in artificial substitutes.
Yes, that's hardly science fiction nowadays, because just yesterday my wife was saying how she was looking forward to ordering an Impossible Burger for lunch. So it's there. Mm-hmm. Is the world that you describe in 2084 the kind of world that you'd want to live in? And is it possible to live in a world like that today?
That's a really good question. Yes, it is a world that I would like to live in, because I live in New York City, which is a place where you are cheek and jowl with the extreme inequalities that we have in American society and increasingly in the world at large. So just the notion of a more equal society in which technology functions, you know, not to create winners and losers, but functions to make everyone their best self, that to me is very attractive. Today, I think it's interesting. In the old days, people set off to build their own utopias. And, there's a huge history of utopias both in Europe and in the United States, none of which ended up doing that well. I think, for one thing, they may not have had the technology necessary to create these sort of highly equal societies, yet societies in which each person can achieve their best potential. I think we're going to have that technology, and I think conceivably we could see regions or local neighborhoods beginning to do things like creating co-ops for more of the basic needs of life, you know, rather than going to corporate clients, corporate suppliers. That's something that we may start to see happen on a regional basis and become, in a way, easier to do because of the software that we're developing. You know, the so-called sharing economy up till now really hasn't been about sharing. It's been more about sort of renting automobiles and letting people pretend to be hoteliers. But ultimately, it really is software that could create powerful sharing among people, not unlike, say, the agricultural co-ops that really functioned to make American agriculture work a century ago. So I think it's possible. And that's exactly how the future will happen. Is it's not, except perhaps with my gigantic spiritual shift in terms of people's feelings about the climate and the planet, I think the way that we get to something approaching utopia is step by step. It's that navigation I talked about, which is, you know, we're always going to the future. We're sort of tacking back and forth as we do it, but we need to have something to go towards. And in my mind, you know, that's utopia. It was Oscar Wilde who said, there is no map of the world worth looking at that does not include a utopia.
Well, thank you for sharing your vision with us today. And if you do find that little corner of utopia, I hope you'll send me an email from the future with directions. Thank you again.
My pleasure.
For more about Michael Rogers, Email from the Future, and potential breakthroughs on our technological horizon, check out my blog item on cosmiclog.com. You'll also find a book recommendation that's related to Pierre Teilhard de Chardin and his concept of the noosphere. It's the latest selection for the Cosmic Log Used Book Club, which highlights classic books with cosmic themes, and you can read it online for free. Thanks to Michael Rogers for the interview, and thanks to James Emily for his rendition of the Fiction Science theme music, composed by yours truly. Please subscribe to our Fiction Science podcast, and feel free to give us a stellar rating on your favorite podcast channel. And so, until next time, this is Alan Boyle advising you to watch the skies.